thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 27 for the 3rd of June, 2008. All a Twitter. I'm Dan Cohen. Time once again for a Digital Campus after our Memorial Weekend break. We're back with the regulars, Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Dan.
And Mills Kelly from edwired.org. Hi, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
So, Mills, I was thinking about your antagonism toward laptops in the classroom and just found this. I don't know if you saw this on the Freakonomics blog on the New York Times, but a guest column by Ian Ayers, who's a law professor at Yale, and he wrote about this law review skit at Yale in which one of the skits had this group of students sitting at desks facing the audience with a professor in front of them who was droning on about some, you know, like tort reform or something like that. And all the students were looking at their laptops except for one who had a deck of cards out and was playing solitaire on the desk. And so the professor turns around and like looks at the student and is like completely outraged and says like, "Why are you playing cards in my classroom?" And then she says, "Well, my laptop is broken." and he said that the whole like audience was laughing, which is mostly students, except the professors were like groaning about this fact. So I thought about your point. By the way, there's some pretty funny comments. We'll link to this article on digitalcampus.tv for this episode. But there were some pretty good comments, and I thought the cleverest one was just have a giant mirror in the back of the classroom facing the students, so that a professor could just glance at the mirror and see who is goofing off on Facebook. Anyway.
Well, I actually know somebody who goes into her classroom and hangs not a huge mirror, but a sort of smallish mirror, probably 8x10, just hangs it on the back wall of the room and says, "That's so that I can see who's playing solitaire," and that kind of thing. And of course, the only person she can really see are the two or three students immediately in front of the mirror. But it gives them this belief that she can see all of their screens. And she said it seems to have cut down on the amount of you know, wandering around the internet that goes on in her class. And it's a very low-tech and inexpensive solution, although I think George Mason might be angry if I went into class with a hammer and a nail and nailed something into the wall.
Yeah, it's certainly quite a solution. Some housekeeping for the Digital Campus audience, because of some great requests from our audience for methods of feedback, particularly people who want to comment on a particular episode but might find themselves in the car or, let's say, out walking and aren't by a computer and so can't go to digitalcampus.tv to write a response, we actually now have a call-in number that we can record comments on, and we'll take those comments. We haven't figured out exactly how this is going to happen technically yet, but we'll take those audio comments and actually attach them to the particular episode. So the Skype number we're doing it via Skype, but it's a regular U.S. number. So if you're calling internationally, it's the +1 703-879-4796. Again, that's 703-879-4796 for call-in responses, and we'll figure out a way to get them up there, and I think that'll add some color to our blog for Digital Campus. So please call us or respond by typing at digitalcampus.tv. Do be sure when you call in to mention the episode number. So, for instance, this one is, I believe, Digital Campus 27. So let's dig into the news. I guess the biggest news story from the past week is, I always love this. It's, you know, it's always a, an adage in politics that you release really bad news right before a holiday weekend, preferably on a Friday. And indeed, that's what Microsoft did by backing out of their participation in mass digitization projects at a number of libraries and sort of in an umbrella sense for their collaboration with the Internet Archive and the Open Content Alliance. And Microsoft had really been a kind of, a counterweight to the other filthy rich company doing this, who's doing it in a very different way, Google. And I don't know what you guys thought about this when this news story broke. I mean, what I found really odd is that, I mean, just this week, I'm not sure if Microsoft told the British Library yet, but I was really interested in the British Library 19th Century Book Digitization Project as a Victorianist. And they announced this collaboration with Microsoft and Microsoft Live Search to scan another 40,000 out-of-copyright books. They seem to have also been left at the altar, as far as I can tell, since Microsoft said they're just getting out of this business entirely.
Well, my response when I saw the news story was Microsoft was scanning books. I pay relatively close attention to the tech news, and I had absolutely no idea that they were scanning books. I can't remember ever seeing in any of the stories about Google Books a reference to, you know, this is a competitor to Microsoft's project or anything like that. So me personally, I'm not going to miss them.
You know, for people in our audience who don't know what Microsoft was doing, I mean, they took a very different tack than Google. Google's really, scanning the entire, they want the entire corpus, the entire library, 15 million volumes or something of that size. That includes books from before 1923, which are all out of copyright, as well as books from after 1923, which, depending on their copyright renewal status and origin, et cetera, may still be in copyright. And for those books, they've been showing snippets. Microsoft did some, I believe, they did some books that were in copyright, but they were mostly focusing on pre-1923 books. And in that way, they hooked in very nicely with the Open Content Alliance, which has digitized through various partners about 400,000 books. We'll give you a link to where you can find those books from digitalcampus.tv. They're basically on the Internet Archive site at this point. But these are all books that are, what I would consider fully free and open. You can download them. You can download the OCR text. They're fully available to do whatever you want with it. And whereas Google, really, you need to go through Google Book Search. They do make PDFs available for some pre-1923 books. It's certainly a different kind of program in both the scale and in the sort of roughshod way they are working with the in-copyright books as well. Tom, what were your reactions to this announcement?
Well, I had kind of mixed reactions. On the one hand, I think that it's sad that a major player with deep pockets has left this arena, and it does kind of leave these institutions who had agreements with Microsoft kind of out on a limb. But on the other hand, I think in some ways it could be a good thing. It may, and maybe this is just wishful thinking on my part, but it may force some of these institutions that had been maybe reluctant to go in with Google to maybe start doing this on their own. I think most of them probably will just jump in bed with Google. Some of them, if they're left with this equipment, the Microsoft left them with the equipment and the workflows and all of the tools to kind of get this done. If some of these institutions were willing to put in some money, or if the Open Content Alliance can raise money from private foundations or other places to do some of this work in a more open way, in a less commercial way, that could be a good thing. I doubt that's going to really happen. I think we should, as digital humanists and people who are interested in these issues, we should be pushing for this and maybe use this as an opportunity to lobby some of these institutions to continue on with Open Content Alliance in a more open way.
Yeah, I openly hoped about that same scenario on my blog this week, and the early signals do not point in that way. I mean, Columbia University Libraries basically said, well, we're just going to expand our efforts with Google then, with Microsoft out of the way. And I guess the overall problem is, you know, do these institutions want to spend a lot of their own money versus the free Google, quote unquote free Google option? I don't think the resulting scans and their kind of legal status and openness are as good as what Microsoft was permitting. But, you know, it's hard to go to your board of trustees and say, well, you know, we'd like to spend $100 million to digitize, 3 million books or 4 million books from Widener Library or from the Columbia University Library. We know we've got this option over here with doing it with Google where they'll do it all for free and give us digital copies back, but we'd like to do it ourselves because we think that the resulting scans will be better. They'll be, more fully available for download to anyone who wants to use them. That just seems like a tough sell.
But it is really apples and oranges in a way. I mean,
it certainly is. Yeah.
It is sort of a tough sell, but presumably these boards of trustees and university presidents and others, provosts are intelligent people, they can be made to see that difference between apples and oranges. And I would hope that the libraries and the librarians, would at least try, to make them see that. Maybe they have. But it seems like a lot of this has happened reflexively without a lot of thinking that Google comes in, offers them a deal, they take it, they run with it, and that's that. And I think maybe, this is a moment to reflect a little bit on that instinct and maybe change it.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, after all, these libraries, the Library at Columbia, if you really look at the cost that's gone into building and sustaining that library, it's probably billions of dollars to buy all the books that are there. And so, you look at a mass digitization project that might cost hundreds of millions, but it's still a small portion of the overall spending on that library over the lifetime of that library. And you think about, certainly we are entering or in a digital age. It seems like you're extending that multi-billion-dollar investment into the future if you do go this a different route than the Google route.
And shouldn't these universities even be looking to private funders to fund this work rather than going to Google? I mean, certainly the Widener Endowment at Harvard, it was in 1911 terms or whatever it was, a lot more than the investment that Google's making in their digitization projects. And so, you'd think that they could hit up those sources again, but it's just I think Google came along first, and they've been quick to this area, and it's kind of just saved these institutions, the effort and the worry, and so it's quick and easy, but it's certainly not the best way to go, and I hope they'll take another look.
Yeah,
I was just going to say, this kind of project has an additional attraction, and that is that in urban areas anyway, where there are multiple university libraries like we have here in the Washington area, there's an ultimate physical plant savings that can go on where, there can be a consolidation of library holdings. I mean, if there are books that just don't circulate all that much, why do the 9 college and university libraries in the Washington area all have to have one copy of them if they're only circulating maybe once every couple of years? Instead, they can, consolidate their holdings into an offsite facility where the books are on 24 or 48-hour call and have 3 copies and make room in the library for new things that are being published, other kinds of learning, teaching, research spaces, without having to add additional physical plant. And that's the kind of thing that I think is really ultimately going to sell these projects to boards of trustee, is to say we can have a digital copy available all the time and to everybody in our library group. And then in addition to that, we'll have a hard copy stored somewhere that somebody who needs the hard copy can get at. They just can't have it in 5 minutes.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Well, I mean, I think that this is, Tom said, I think this is going to focus, everyone's minds on, what they really want for the long term. And I think physical plant considerations are one of those things. Preservation is another, and then usage. What kinds of usage are we going to have in a digital age? And who is going to have those copies? I think is a really critical question. So, in another case of focusing the mind, we've been ranting here at Digital Campus on the podcast for the past year about the impact of web applications on IT infrastructure and staffing at universities, particularly the fact that it seems like all of our students come into freshman year already with a Gmail or Hotmail account, and we couldn't figure out why universities continue to spend so much money on their own email accounts and associated other software that is rapidly moving onto the web. And I think we're now getting some signs of this. This is a rather painful focusing of the mind, but University of Washington is going to cut 66 jobs. It's about 15% of their staff in their IT division, which is used to support people in their email and other application usages. Beginning of a trend? Because of this fact, I mean, that people are using these free web apps from Google and Microsoft.
I think it's got to be. I mean, this is a particularly large layoff that's a part of a larger layoff of faculty and staff at the university. But I'm sure this is not the first time this has happened. I think some of the other universities who have moved to Gmail or to Microsoft Live email have probably made similar cuts, maybe not to this extent and maybe not this publicly, but I imagine that there's been some attrition and some gradual letting of staff go. And I think that's only going to continue. It's sad for the people who are losing their jobs, obviously, but I think it's probably the wave of the future.
Yeah, I think it's actual, it's inevitable that these kinds of changes are going to occur, because it's just, again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the libraries, is that for the business side of the university, and, even George Mason is close to a $1 billion business, and we're not all that big and important yet. And for the business side of the university, these kinds of cost savings are really, really attractive, especially in an era where both the federal government and state governments have been reducing their overall commitment to higher education, and private money gets harder and harder to come by. Anything that can save a significant amount of money through an efficiency is going to be, I think, just impossible to not take advantage of.
Yeah, and I mean something like email, really, and web-based email, it really has become a commodity. You can get dozens and dozens of very good and very secure free email accounts. I mean, we all know that. You can go to Yahoo or Google or any one of 100 others. And in that area, in that world where email is a commodity and it's basically a free commodity, it doesn't really make any sense for universities to be paying for it when the rest of the world is getting it free. So that unfortunately means some jobs for the staff who used to maintain it. But I think that's the way it's probably going to go.
Longtime listeners of the podcast will know that one of the leitmotifs is yours truly, Dan Cohen, succumbing to technologies that he swears he would never, ever use in a million years. And indeed, over the last couple of months, I've decided to join the hordes on Twitter, which is I guess what would generally be called a micro-blogging platform. And indeed, it enforces the micro-ness of your blogging in that you have to keep all posts to the service, little messages to the service, under 140 characters. I guess we can explain why that is later on. But it is a very popular service, and I think particularly in the technology and humanities crowd, I've really noticed that there was a kind of sea change in the last couple of months that people were joining Twitter and using it as a form of communication. And it's a little bit hard to explain in the abstract of why you'd want to do this, and I hope that people who listen to the podcast know that I have a regular blog in which I am often quite long-winded, far beyond 140 characters. And we've also discussed on the podcast just the simple drain on our time that technology takes and what we can do about that. And adding in another platform to communicate on, along with email and instant messaging and blog comments, puts increasing pressure on our lives. So why would we use this service is the question for today, of a microblogging service where you might do shorter posts rather than longer blog posts. maybe we'd start, Tom, with you. You were the first of us on Twitter. What's your experience from the last year? What have you learned about the advantages of using this kind of a microblogging system? What do you gain from it? What are the advantages? Before we get into the disadvantages, which somehow I have a feeling will come from the third party on this Skype call.
Well, okay, I can try to promote the advantages. I mean, in some respects, it's just fun. And there's an element of play to Twitter that I think can't be discounted. So, I mean, you know, if you want me to tell you that it's going to, that it's, you know, the ultimate productivity tool, well, that's not the case. So let's throw that out there, and that's I think a worthy and useful end in itself. So, but beyond that, I've been using Twitter since pretty close to the beginning, since like early March of 2007, right before the South by Southwest conference that we sent a few of our staff members to, and that was really where Twitter broke out, the South by Southwest conference. In 2007, and it kind of gained a big following there. And it was a way that I found that I was jealous of our staff members who got to go to South by Southwest. I didn't get to go. I found immediately that they were tweeting, which is what you, a post in Twitter is called a tweet. They were tweeting, the conference. And so it was a way for me to follow, on a kind of, you know, minute to minute or 10 minute basis, what was going on, where they were, what kinds of talks they were going to, panels, and other things. And not just that, but they were tweeting, you know, the parties they were attending and other things. So in a way, you got a really good sense of kind of the feel of what South by Southwest, was like that year. And then I continued on, as more and more people, joined Twitter and, gradually over the course of that year, we saw more and more people and initially, from the library world, I think especially, the librarians caught on to this really pretty quickly. And in fact, some of them were on it well before I was. It's become, I think, a place, especially among librarians with a digital bent, to, share links to update one another on various conferences that people are attending, to share professional news, to schedule meetups. If someone's in a certain town, they'll say, "Well, I'm in Chicago for the day. Would anybody like to meet for a drink?" And you know, you'll see people meeting up over Twitter. It's a very easy way to send a kind of broadcast message to a group of people who you have something in common with. It is a hard thing to explain in words. Probably the best thing to do is to try it out. If you don't feel like committing and want to see a demonstration of it, I can send people to a website called Common Craft, where they have a kind of video animation that shows you what Twitter is and why you might want to use it. If you go to www.commoncraft.com/Twitter, there's a great little video that shows you, you know, why you might want to use this. But I've actually found it to be a great way of establishing a community of interest, of maintaining that community with kind of very low overhead. You know, I don't need to spend a lot of time writing posts. I can't spend a lot of time. That's 140 characters. And sharing in small snippets of information and really becoming part of something larger. Amazingly, most of my followers and friends on Twitter are people who I've never met, but I have actually a lot in common with. So, I am an advocate of Twitter. I think it's been good for me, for my career, for my blog, for just my place in the crowd of digital humanists. So, I'll be happy to argue with Mills about the about the cons.
Well, I, Yeah, Mills, why don't you opening arguments? Yes.
Yeah, and I just would like to make it clear that I am in fact not on Twitter, so I'm speaking as a complete outsider here who makes no use of this service, and so I'm just trying to kind of I'm like the audience who doesn't know what Twitter is. I'm still kind of wrapping my mind around the whole thing because it sounds a little bit like the ultimate resource for voyeurs in a text-based voyeurism kind of thing. Like, I was just sort of listening to what Tom was saying, and I was thinking, like, I can just imagine, like, what a librarian, in addition to the, you know, the links and I'm in Chicago and let's go get a drink or whatever. So do people tweet that I just reshelved a book?
Well, some do, in my experience. Okay. I mean, I think, you know, as someone in the middle, I think, you know, and as a new Twitter user, you know, I think that Twitter has reestablished some of the best and, alas, worst parts of early blogging that I think all three of us have tried to get away from on our blogging. I mean, originally a blog was, you know, a weblog. It was a set of links and, you know, here's what I found. Unfortunately, it in this, I think, colored subsequent views of blogging within academia, I think it was also, you know, I'm eating a sandwich for lunch today with a yogurt. And so I think, you know, Twitter does have some of that. I think that there is, you know, particularly heavy users might be saying what they're doing each and every hour, and it's not very helpful. And I can't seem to, you know, pay attention at that level to 100 people's lives who I'm following on Twitter. On the other hand, I think Tom is right that it does something that a blog can't do, which is that if you have a quick question, you know, hey, has anyone used this piece of software, or could someone tell me about a good book about this? It has a certain immediacy that a blog post won't get you. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that the posts are so short is to encourage that kind of, you know, quick call and response. Of course, being under not only 140 characters but 160 characters means that you can also receive these messages on your phone or any other electronic service that uses something called SMS, which is a simple messaging system that a lot of phones have. And so it is a way to kind of broadcast in a way that a blog won't do. And I think a lot of Twitter clients or software that uses it, you know, are a lot more kind of rapid. Indeed, that's part of Twitter's ongoing technical problems is that, you know, people want these, you know, tweets right away and they want to participate in real time. And, you know, I think the best description I've heard of it is it's like a water cooler at work. You know, people, you know, in their little break times, they'll go to the water cooler and, you know, talk about the basketball game from last night or, you know, things that they're thinking about doing. And, you know, some people are there and you kind of drift in and out, and it doesn't require constant attention or even really, you know, it can be fun. It can be work related. It can be a lot of different things. Tom, would you agree with that description?
Yeah, I would. I mean, it is, I think at first when I started using Twitter, I had, and there's a lot of different settings, so you can decide how you want to receive the messages, how you want to post the messages, what volume of messages you get, who you want to receive messages from, and how. So at first, I tried to read every message and keep up with the entire stream of messages. And that was sort of doable when I had 4 or 5 friends. Now with having, you know, 100 or more, that's impossible. I mean, there's thousands of tweets a day that come through my account. And, it's impossible to keep up with them all. And a lot of them aren't, you know, as we said, it's like a lot of them are, I'm getting a cup of coffee or I'm shelving a book. And so you don't really want to keep up with all of them. But what I've kind of, Leo Laporte on the Twit podcast kind of brought me around to this. He said that you don't have to keep up with it all. You just kind of have to wade in the stream, you know, you don't, to enjoy and to benefit from the service, you don't need to try to read every single tweet. You just need to kind of wade in the stream of information. And so I tune into Twitter, if I have my laptop open, if I'm checking email, if I'm not trying to concentrate on writing something. And the stuff just kind of pops up, and sometimes it's interesting and sometimes it's not. It's almost like background music, or having the TV on while you're cooking or something. It just has it creates a kind of ambiance, and it's a community based ambiance. I mean, I really think that's what has done it for me, is I really do feel like I'm part of this community of people, who some of whom I've met, some of whom I haven't met, who have very similar interests, and it positions you, it allows you to kind of position yourself even professionally, in a little bit of a different way. So it's been a good thing for me, I think.
See, I'm still, like I said, I'm a total non-user, but I'm visualizing the waiting in the stream, and it's exactly why I don't have cable TV, because when I had cable TV, I would sit on the sofa with the clicker and just rotate through the channels, because waiting in the stream of information, because I was sure there had to be something worth watching. And I know that if I was a Twitter user, I would wait in that stream because there would have to be something interesting in that stream that I would then want to pay attention to. And so thank God I'm not, only because I'm so far behind on six different things already that if I started doing that, waiting in that stream, I would probably have to quit my job and do something else.
I think that's the big question. I think I don't have the answer to that question, is like, does Twitter take my time? Like, does it suck my time, or is it sort of time neutral? And I can't really say. I mean, you know, on the one hand, it is drawing my attention to some extent. On the other hand, I don't spend a whole lot of time actually, you know, focused on it. It really is more like background noise. But maybe that background noise is distracting me from things I should be doing, and the size of my to-do list suggests that possibly it is. But I don't know if it certainly is not as overwhelming as my feed reader is. My Google reader, where all my RSS feeds and all the blogs that I read, that is much more overwhelming and much more intimidating to me than Twitter. I feel much more like I have to focus and read those blogs than I do like I have to look at Twitter. In some respects, it's a relief, from all of that other, you know, stream. Maybe that's not a stream. Maybe that's a river or a tsunami over on my reader. But I think that is a good question. Like, is this distracting me? Is this taking my time? Dan, what do you think about that?
I'm still filling this out as an early user. I think it is, as Mill said, that the temptation's there. I mean, I am allowing myself on Twitter to, you know, do things I don't do. I'm very strict about on my blog. Talking about, you know, what's happening at home, you know, what's going on with my kids, those sorts of things. I'm letting that go out into Twitter, because I think, you know, on Twitter, it is a more casual environment. And I think, you know, I think that's helpful. I don't really have that on my blog or somewhere else. So I think it's one good area where, you know, like Tom, you and I can talk about the Celtics game. on the other hand, and I also appreciate that community feature and the ability to ask questions. You know, for instance, I asked people on Twitter before this podcast, why do they use Twitter? And I instantly got back five responses. And you get that kind of immediacy, which is really nice. Now, you know, on the other hand, it is tempting to get embroiled, I think, in some discussions. There's a lot of links tossed out, and you can, I think in that way, on the good side, well, maybe it is the first place where you see some new interesting thing, before you see it, let's say, in Google Reader or on your blog reader. On the other hand, I could spend a lot of time clicking on that. So I'm kind of learning, in a sense, to, ignore it at the right level, Tom, which is hard, because I'm coming to it from, my news reader, my blog reader, and there, I really feel, because I take blogging seriously, I really feel like, okay, if I sit down in front of my Google Reader and I open up my digital humanities folder, you know, I'm going to look at each one of those posts very carefully, because I feel like I need to give the amount of time to those people that I would expect they would give my blog posts, and I don't want to just skim through them. Whereas on Twitter, I'm sort of learning, like, you know, I just rifle through them and, you know, see if there's anything interesting. I do think, you know, one advantage on Twitter is that there are direct messages and there are kind of at messages where people sort of specifically direct you a question. And in that way, it kind of can replace some sort of like a cheap email system, in that if something's really urgent or, you know, someone wants some specific advice from me, I can give that via Twitter. And I can do it in a way that might answer some other people's questions as well. So,
right. And I think that's actually
that public part of it. Yeah.
That's a very, in some ways, a very helpful feature. The reply, the @, so you send a message to someone at their name, but other people in your network, let's say, can see that message as well. So they get the benefit of that conversation. But at the same time, I think there's something really helpful in some ways about the 140 character limit. To me, it's kind of liberating. Whereas when I go to my blog and I want to post something, I feel like I've got to at least write a 3-sentence paragraph. Like, I can't just post a sentence fragment on my blog, even if I have something, you know, fairly interesting to tell, you know, my readers. I can do that on Twitter, where I just, you know, and I just post a link, and that in some ways is very freeing, as we said. And also, if people, I've noticed that when people send me a message through Twitter, asking me a specific question, I can respond on Twitter and not feel bad about not writing them a, you know, well-formed, well-thought-out email with a salutation and everything else. I mean, I can just kind of respond in 120 characters and give them the answer they're looking for without feeling like I need to, you know, be a good correspondent. And so that's kind of freeing as well. The other thing I'd say is, in some ways, I think it's actually improved my writing, which is kind of ridiculous. But I really do think that being limited to 140 characters, it teaches you to be very concise in your writing, and to eliminate a lot of the extra words that we use. And so, in some ways, it's kind of a good writer's drill. So I think that the fact that it's 140 characters creates some interesting possibilities and interesting constraints that move you in certain directions that I think are sometimes in some ways beneficial.
Yeah. Well, the longer term problem to something like Twitter is now all the things that are kind of growing up around it and competing services, where you could imagine, you know, there's Jaiku, which is now owned by Google. There's even worse, FriendFeed, which I'm not sure if, Tom, are you on FriendFeed yet?
Which
aggregates all of your other feeds. And, you know, I think Mills, your dystopia might very well be coming true, because you add up all these microblogging and your Flickr feed and your YouTube feeds and your Delicious
Facebook
feed.
Stats.
And, you get this just sea of RSS, of little messages. FriendFeed tries to aggregate it all in one spot, but then, you know, it's grabbing your Twitter stuff, so you're getting it both from Twitter and from FriendFeed. So, you know, the level of messaging could exponentially grow, and I think that's probably the long-term issue. Well, if you want to delve into Twitter, you can go to twitter.com, twitter.com, and we'll plug Tom at Is Found History on Twitter, and Dan Cohen at Twitter, all one word. So
but you'll have to look somewhere else for Mills Kelly.
You should grab your name while it's still available, Mills, just in case you decide to use it. Okay, well, I guess we'll check back in on this and see if it makes our top 10 for 2008 at the end of the year. Time for Picks of the Week. Mills, what do you have for us?
I'm going to mention a podcast that I enjoy. It's Media Berkman at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. And they just have all kinds of interesting things going on there. Some of the they deal with a lot of legal issues. They have just recently had a digital natives forum. It's a wide variety of things happening in the internet and with, you know, taking a kind of a broad perspective on some of the key issues. And so some of the podcast is just audio, some of it's video. So it's a nice way to stay in touch with, some of these issues.
Great. So these are talks that go on at the Berkman Center? Or
there are talks that go on at the Berkman Center. There are conferences that go on there. They have some regular contributors. It's just a variety of things.
Okay, terrific. I'll have to check that out. I've been impressed with their work over the years. Tom, what do you have for us?
I actually have a blog post. One of the terms I think that has cropped up in the last year or two, I guess a couple of years, and that we're hearing more and more is the term semantic web. And I think that term probably confuses a lot of people. It kind of confuses me, and it's used in a lot of different ways to mean a lot of different things. And so I'm going to point to a blog post on Read Write Web, which is a great tech blog called Semantic Web Patterns, A Guide to Semantic Technologies. And it kind of goes through the different meanings of the term semantic web and the technologies that are kind of grouped under this heading of semantic web. I think it clarified some things for me, and I think it would for our listeners as well.
Great. Do you know if that post is by Alex Iskold?
Yes, it's by Alex Iskold.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, right. So he is the I don't know if he's the chief technology officer or the CEO, but he's behind Blue Organizer, which is
right.
A Firefox plugin that uses some semantic web principles to grab information about books and movies off of the web and that you can store.
Right. And Zotero uses semantic web principles.
Yeah, and indeed, part of my beef with Alex is he never mentions Zotero since we're a competing open source project to Blue Organizer, and I think have many more users actually than Blue Organizer. This is the advantage of writing on a major blog where you don't have to talk about your competitors. Okay, that sounds like a great post, and we'll post all this to digitalcampus.tv. For this week, I just want to point to a kind of early alpha release of a wiki that Lisa Spiro, and I hope I'm getting her last name correct. She's going to be at that camp, which we'll talk about in just a second. And some other researchers are putting together for digital research tools. I should point out that we actually at the Center for History and New Media launched one of these wikis a few years ago, but it's sort of been a little neglected. We were hoping that the digital humanities community would contribute to it more than they did, although we did end up with, I think, over 100 tools listed on this. But this new wiki, I think, we've definitely told them that they can, grab anything they want from our wiki. And I think also the fact that I think there's 5 or 6 of them that are really going to work on it means that it has, I think, a better chance of really being more comprehensive than what we were able to do on our own. And this wiki is at digitalresearchtools.pbwiki.com, as in peanut butter wiki, pbwiki.com, digitalresearchtools.pbwiki.com. And it's already got, I think, a lot of good tools. I actually found a couple tools there that I didn't really know about. Unlike the wiki we did at CHNM, it sort of breaks it down, I think, maybe a little bit more intuitively for the end user. So, so there's tools that work with, you know, audio and video, tools that do specific things, in that way, I think it's pretty helpful, maybe for new users, rather than people who are already in the digital humanities community. It's a good place to send new users to look for tools that might be helpful to their work. Well, as I mentioned, Lisa is one of several dozen people who are joining us at the Center for History and New Media this weekend. We're actually recording this just before that camp, which is the Humanities and Technology Camp. It's available at thatcamp.org. Unfortunately, we had to turn away a lot of people, which we're upset about, but we wanted to keep it a kind of small group so we could, keep everything a little bit more casual and interactive. But we'll be having another one next year. But you should check out, I think, just going to thatcamp.org and looking at some of what's going on. It's a unconference. Tom, do you want to say a couple of words about that camp and what will be going on this weekend? And we should say that on the next podcast, we'll talk about what happened and maybe even have some interviews with people who were there.
Sure. Just briefly, that camp is an unconference. It's kind of a bar camp style, if people are familiar with bar camp style conference, where the participants are going to kind of self-organize on the first morning of the conference. So there aren't formal papers and, you know, proposals for panels. It's more that a group of like-minded people interested in digital humanities, are going to get together and decide, as a group, what are the most important issues? What are the things they really want to talk about? And then we're going to, break up into groups where we're going to do hands-on presentations. We're going to do demonstrations. People are actually going to be coding, doing some coding around tables and trying to work through some real world issues. The idea is that everybody who attends, has to present or has to participate in some way, has to actively engage. There are no panels where people can just observe and watch. You can't just come and attend. You have to actively participate. And so this is the first one of these we've done. We're doing it, I think, impressively on almost no budget. I think that's part of the idea too, that it's really a kind of ad hoc thing where we don't need to spend a whole lot of money. We don't need to have a whole infrastructure and staff. We can just kind of get together and really be productive and do things on the cheap. And so we're doing that this weekend. We're really excited. I think a lot of listeners will be there, and we will talk about it next time.
Terrific. We will indeed talk about that, as well as many other topics from the news in the humanities and technology. And so Mills and Tom, I will see you this weekend and at that camp. And we'll see the rest of you or hear from the rest of you. Remember our new phone number mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, or you can just go to digitalcampus.tv to write comments on this episode. And we'll hear from you again in another 2 weeks on another episode of Digital Campus.
Thing we have to fear is fear itself, fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not.